Jason Carthy.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are here live at the Pavilion Theatre in beautiful downtown Dunleary. Thank you all for coming out tonight. You might know us as the hosts of a podcast called Nothing Is Real, which has been going... pandering. If you don't know us, we've done about 180 episodes over the last 5 years of anything to do with the Beatles, from Sgt. Pepper to Paul McCartney's songs about birds, which is probably my favourite. Yep. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Why are we here tonight, Stephen?
We are here tonight because it is 60 years, almost, since A Hard Day's Night was released in July 1964. This film is probably many people's entry point to the Beatles. It's not just a film about the Beatles. I think it tells you a lot about the social history of the 60s and the period. We're going to look at, obviously, the stars of the film, the people who were involved in making it. And it was only 20 months from their first single until they're on the big screen. A lot happened in that 20 months, and a lot happened in terms of potential films and things that didn't happen and things that almost happened. And yep, we're going to look at all of that.
We're going to look at all of that. So 20 months, that's like somebody putting out a single in August 2022 and suddenly having a worldwide film being released today. It's that kind of timeline. And of course, you know, the film doesn't come out of nowhere. It happens in the midst of their kind of ascending fame. And we're going to pull on all those threads tonight. Before we get going, there is a little bit of housekeeping that we want to do. Please, no photos, no video, no audio recording. Dave, any other things we need to say?
I don't think so. Switch your phones off. Yes. Make sure everything's on silent. Smartwatches, pacemakers, switch all them all off.
There will be an interval. So our plan is we're going to run long, but we'll try not to. 55 minutes for the first half, about a 15-minute interval, and then come straight back for more of the same.
10-minute second half.
Yeah. enough time for a Teddy's or to just escape. And there's that as well. And the show is packed, so we're not doing a Q&A at the end.
No.
But what will we be doing?
We will be, or Mark will be, in the foyer afterwards if you want to get anything signed, if you brought books with you. And I think I saw some books available for purchase.
How fortuitous.
Just coincidentally.
Finally, they're here. Shall we get on with the show? Okay. Let's introduce the man himself. He is the world's foremost Beatles historian and biographer. He's hard at work at Volume 2, so let's not mention it again. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mark Lewison. Oh, Ringo's theme.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for coming, everybody. It's really wonderful to be here.
Hard Day's Night. Where Stephen mentioned there that it's a lot of people's entry point for the Beatles. When did you first see A Hard Day's Night?
Not in 1964. I mean, I'm only 27 now. So. I don't know exactly. It might have even been when it was on television. Mm. I saw it once in a cinema in South Harrow, near London where I lived, and it was in a double bill with Help. I'm not quite sure when that was, but there were kids screaming in the cinema, and I'm trying to get them to shut up, well, unsuccessfully, but I wanted to hear what the dialogue on the screen, but unfortunately people were still screaming.
Were you a Beatles fan already at the time?
Huge.
Yeah.
But in 1964 I was only six, so I think you had to be really taken by a parent, you know, to a film like this. Even though it was youth certificate, you couldn't go in at six on your own.
Did your parents encourage you in your Beatle?
Yeah, my mother was a Beatles fan. But the main thing they didn't do was discourage me. So at no point did I feel that this obsession that was taking over my life was something that I ought to be setting on one side. You know, they were fine with it.
Fair enough.
So, and it was great. It was absolutely great. Great to grow up in a household where my mum had a picture of the Beatles on the kitchen door. And I used to laugh at the boots. Yeah, because I'd never seen anything like them before. Yeah.
What about you, Stephen?
I have to say my entry point was Help.
Okay.
I'm a colour film guy. But I do remember, I think I first saw it on television, and it might have been quite late. I think they were shown around 78, 79, around Christmas time.
Christmas 79, BBC Two showed five Beatles films, and that was an entry point for a lot of people.
And so then, of course, you go out and you buy it on VHS. And then you buy it on DVD, and then you buy it on Blu-ray. And
then you watch it for free on YouTube.
Then you watch it for free on YouTube.
Yeah.
I've brought along my cute 1989 entry to A Hard Day's Night, Unrewound, which is interesting, which I think was from 1989. And, I was already a Beatles listener at the minute, and I think in that way of teenagers at the time, maybe I didn't appreciate it, because I think teenagers like the full-colour Beatles,
yeah,
first of all, and then you go back a little bit later and realise what the magic is in something like A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, Hard Day's Night is, people often say, oh, I don't watch anything in black,
black and white.
I can't think why they would say that. But it's meant to be in black and white, because it's like a newsreel film of the day. It's actually evoking real events, and everything was in those days black and white.
Yeah. So let's pull the thread of A Hard Day's Night then. Yes. We're going to start, because we talked there about there is 20 months between their first single and A Hard Day's Night coming out. But the decision to make A Hard Day's Night starts when they're not at the pinnacle of their fame. It starts when they're on the way up, you could say.
Yeah. Well, in those days, there were star films for the likes of Elvis Presley and Cliff Richard. They were fairly good budget films, but there were also lots of other films derisively called jukebox musicals. And basically the idea was that you get a whole load of acts to come to the studio, they would mime to one song, and they would be the flimsiest of storyline threads that would actually pin it all together. And then you put it out as a film, and the Beatles went to the pictures, like we all did, to see whatever music could be seen, and they hated those films. they had a very strong opinion about them, and they knew they didn't ever want to be in one.
Right.
So from quite early on, they were offered the chance to be in films, and they said, no, we don't want to be in any of those films.
Yeah.
In fact, we're going to bring up this quote here from Melody Maker.
Yeah, so this is John, June the 15th, 1963. We've been offered some parts in a backstage show sort of film where about 20 different pop stars all appear with no story and no meaning. We prefer to wait until we find a film with a good plot that will hold the interest of the teenagers. Otherwise, it might do us more harm than good. And they had a gift at saying no to the wrong ideas.
Yeah, that is the key thing about the Beatles, is they not only say yes to the right ideas, they said no to the wrong ones.
I mean, it's quite striking that they had the confidence at that stage, and that Brian endorsed that, you know, we're not going to do this, because at this stage no one knew how long this was going to last.
Exactly that. I mean, their bubble might have burst much sooner than, well, it never burst, but it could have burst any time. And they were actually saying, we'd rather not be in a film than be in something we're embarrassed about. Even if we're never in a film, we're happier with that decision than being in one of those rubbish films.
And it's the exact same kind of method that they were asked to record How Do You Do, and then they decide, no, we want to do our own songs, thank you very much.
Yeah, they held out for what they wanted. And because of that, and of course the talent that they had, everything just kind of fell the way it should do. Yeah. But there was no guarantee that was going to happen. Yeah. And we've got some posters here of films that they might have been in. We're going to see five posters here.
So what
of British films. Actually, What a Crazy World is not a bad film. But it's not brilliant, but it's not a bad film. But It's All Over Town is a truly awful film. Thank God they weren't in that. Tommy Steele, It's All Happening, that's a really bad film. The Yellow Teddy Bears, that's a little bit more interesting. That was based on a book about girls at school who would wear a little yellow teddy bear to indicate that they were willing to have sex. And in those days, in 1963, this was
children?
Quite controversial.
Yes.
Quite a controversial thing. So they were offered a spot in that film just as a musical interlude, and they said no. And the same with the last one, Saturday Night Out. And the Searchers got the gig instead. So the Searchers were in a film because the Beatles wouldn't do it.
And it's about April 1963 that people, you know, the Beatles are putting out From Me to You, Please Please Me album's about to come out. So it's very early days, but they are starting to get the offers around that time. People are starting to
They are. And there was a guy called Giorgio Gomelsky, who was an eccentric music lover and club owner, who had a club in Richmond that had R&B music, and he put on the Rolling Stones. And he wanted to make a film. He sort of managed the Stones, but not quite. But he wanted to make a film with the Stones and with the Beatles, separate films, not together. And the Beatles met him and had discussions about the script. And it would have been quite interesting. Ronan O'Reilly, who would the Irishman who would eventually start Radio Caroline, he was going to be involved in this as well. But ultimately, it just kind of fell apart. And then later in the year, the right kind of offers came along. That would have been a little 20-minute thing.
Yeah.
a full-length film offer came later.
My sense of Giorgio was that he was a guy who was kind of buzzing around with ideas. Like, he's kind of best known as being involved in the early Yardbirds.
Yeah.
But he's whether he actually managed to pull anything off, that was kind of proper execution.
He was an enthusiast.
Yes.
Giorgio was a great enthusiast, and he ran around and spouting all these enthusiastic ideas, but never quite nailing any of them down, which is why Andrew Oldham was able to take the Rolling Stones off him, because he hadn't quite got them under contract like he should have done.
But he would say that he came up with the idea of a sort of documentary day in the life style approach to making a film.
Yes, he did. And there was Ronan O'Reilly said that years later, Brian Epstein apologized for kind of stealing the idea to some degree with A Hard Day's Night. I don't know exactly how true that is.
Yeah. It's worth mentioning that 1963 is the year of Cliff's Summer Holiday, and Elvis's had happened at the World's Fair, so that's the kind of pop movie that people were going to see at the time.
Yeah.
But the people who get brought in to A Hard Day's Night are the people that make it special.
Yes.
And we should probably talk about Alan Owen, first of all.
Yeah, Alan Owen was a Liverpudlian, a Liverpool Welshman, but he wrote quite tough dramas. He hadn't written anything about pop music before, anything light or frivolous even, but he had a good turn of humour, but he wrote quite tough stage plays or TV plays. And in particular, there was one based in Liverpool called No Tram to Lime Street. And the Beatles, because before they were famous, they would be at home watching TV like lots of people. They saw this and thought, that guy writes good work. And eventually, come 1963, they get on to Brian and say, Brian, will you write him a letter and ask if he wants to do a film for us?
Yeah, so the letter, for those of you who can't see, I'll do my best Brian Epstein impression. I was wondering whether you would wish to be associated in connection with a film on behalf of the Beatles, of whom I am manager and agent. I thought that you would be particularly suitable as a writer of material which would showcase these artists. Suitably. In any event, both the Beatles and myself have greatly admired much of your work in the past. I would look forward to hearing from you.
So,
lovely turn of phrase.
They've got their idea right away that if they're going to do a film, they would like someone really good to write it. Even though he had no track record in the field, he was obviously capable of it. And in particular, he was from Liverpool, and that was vital. They weren't going to be fobbed off with some southerner, you know, who wouldn't understand the way they spoke.
But there's a quote from Paul. There's a biography of Dick Lester, and he says, Paul wrote the foreword, and he said he knew they were home and dry when Alan Owen came on board. So they were involved at that stage, and they had confidence in him.
Yeah. Well, as it turns out, the people who are going to make the film, they knew Alan Owen as well. So when Brian and the Beatles said, we've already written to Alan Owen, well, they said, that's perfect because we know him too.
Did they write to anyone else?
Or was that I know of.
Yeah.
Not that I know of.
It was a long shot. That
it was a long shot, although Richard Lester, the director, we'll get onto him in a minute, he wanted to bring in Johnny Spate as the writer. And Johnny Spate was too busy with a TV show called The Arthur Haynes Show. No one's going to remember this anymore. put your hand up if you remember The Arthur Haynes Show.
Oh, that's okay.
Hello. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
And Johnny Spate, of course, went on to write Till Death Us Do Part, which is another extraordinary thing. The man who wrote Till Death might have written the first Beatles film. But he didn't. He didn't.
So Alan Owen is kind of signed up earlier on, or he gets involved earlier on. So we should probably then walk through some of the other people who are key players.
Yeah. The film, Hard Day's Night, really began because United Artists was a film company. It had a music division. And a man in the music division thought, if we get a film with the Beatles, we'll get the publishing on the songs, and maybe we'll get the soundtrack rights as well. So that was the route by which it took birth. And then the man on the left in this picture is Bud Ornstein. He was an American. He ran UA in Europe, United Artists in Europe. And so Bud Ornstein, really, he brought in Walter Shenson, the man on the right, as the producer. And we also see Paul McCartney, of course, and Brian Epstein. So it's Bud Ornstein and Walter Shenson who really fast-tracked this from this point on.
And this was, I mean, it's a closed circuit really here, because I think it was Ned Rogers was the original UA man who goes to Dick James, who goes to Brian Epstein, and then all these people are just following them up.
But yeah, it's the right course of action, but it all happens quite quickly.
Yes, and the notion that it's a quick cash-in film is not true, and it's interesting that the narrative is that in September, October 63, the Beatles can't get arrested in America, and here's an American company making a long-term punt on hopefully getting a soundtrack album.
United Artists were, first of all, they were most unlike any other film production company in that what they basically said was, here's the money, go away and make it, let us know when you finished, as opposed to getting involved in every single detail and every single level. So they were very good for artists and directors and producers to be given a free hand. But they were the first American company interested in the Beatles. But they've always said that, and everyone involved in the film always said it was a quick cash-in film, but there was no way from October 63 that they could have begun shooting it any earlier than February 64, and no way that it could have come out any earlier than July 64. So that isn't exactly a quick cash-in, because it had the bubble burst sooner than July 64, arguably, they would have been left with, you know, holding a film that no one wanted to see. But I think they had greater long-term faith in the Beatles. You also read that the budget was only 200,000, but that was plenty enough.
Yeah,
it really was.
But there is this sense that perhaps United Artists, I mean, they signed a deal with Shenson, where after 15 years, Shenson gets the rights to the movie. So although it wasn't a quick cash in, they had certainly no sense. No one had a sense at that stage. This was going to be worth having in 15 years.
It would seem so. I spoke to the guy at UA who really, this Bud Ornstein and his colleague in New York, David Picker, who I interviewed, and he says that's one of the worst things we ever did was give away the rights after 15 years. He couldn't explain why it had happened. But
because it was perfect for video, cable, streaming, Blu-ray, DVD. I mean,
he should have seen any of that.
And now A Hard Day's Night is owned by an American billionaire. Called Bruce Karsh, who's actually a big Beatles fan and does good things with it. He takes good care of it and allowed a good re-release in 2014 for the 50th anniversary. So it's in good hands, but it's odd that someone else completely owns it.
Yeah. We sometimes on the podcast, we do fun facts. Can I give a fun fact about Bud Ornstein?
Yes.
His daughter Susie married Neil Aspinall in 1968.
It's
all connected.
It's all connected.
It is all connected, yeah. Well, even more connected, her first husband, at the time when this was all going on, her first husband was one of the guys who got the Beatles merchandising rights.
It's all about who you know.
Yeah.
Never try and out fun fact, Mark.
We have had our
always got a funnier one.
There's also this notion that they had to shoot in black and white, but they didn't have to.
They didn't have to. Richard Lester wanted to shoot in black and white because he wanted it to be like a film, a newsreel. I say that's an old-fashioned word now, but TV was black and white, and it was. The Beatles were seen by people in black and white, apart from when they went out to a show. Everything on television was black and white, so it was right that the film was too.
Well, I found a quote from Alan Owen, and he said at the time, "They are immediate people, and I knew from that it couldn't be a colour film. The boys are essentially black and white people."
Yeah.
But as you say, people at home saw them in black and white. They saw them in the cinema, newsreels, TV covers, pages in newspapers. It was a black and white world.
It's a black and white world, and the way that Richard Lester filmed this in London, it's that immediate post-war, it's only 20 years after the Second World War, it's that black and white London, if you like. London isn't yet colour.
Well, this is what we were saying in the introduction. It's sort of a social document because you can see the railway stations, the backgrounds, the landscape, the architecture, which isn't there anymore.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And I know that because I've made it my business to try and find as many of the locations as possible, and there aren't that many left now, unfortunately.
And the Beatles got a good deal out of this as well. They weren't fobbed off. They were paid all right.
Yeah, it's gone down in Beatles history through Philip Norman's book, Shout, that Brian got a very... Brian Epstein was so naive, he got them a very weak deal, but actually it wasn't weak at all. No. I think his initial pitch might have been weak, but ultimately they got £25,000 and 23% of the profits.
It's not bad.
It's not bad. For a first film.
So we've mentioned Ornstein and Shenson, and Shenson had worked with Dick Lester before.
Yes, he had.
And so this is the next part of the jigsaw.
Yeah, Shenson brought in Lester as the director. They had worked on this Mouse on the Moon. Margaret Rutherford, Bernard Cribbins and Terry Thomas. A good British comedy film. Now, Lester was from America. But he was young and absolutely loved. He was a real Anglophile who loved the British sense of humour, the arcane sense of humour. He fell in very quickly with Peter Sellers, Spike and that whole crowd, Spike Milligan. And so he was, though American, he saw like a British director, but probably just with a little bit of extra edge as well. So Mouse on the Moon was their film. So Lester brings in Shenson brings in Lester. Now, the thing about Lester is he did work with all those people. But in the Beatles world, there was somebody else who worked with the same set of people as well, and that was George Martin. The Beatles' music producer had really earned his spurs by creating the incredible albums by Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan and Michael Benteen, and even a thing called An Evening of British Rubbish, which was Bruce Lacey and his gang in the Alberts.
The Alberts.
Who were really kind of bonkers. It's like very eccentric, very, very, like early Bonzo Dog.
I was going to say sort of pre-Bonzo Bonzo.
Yeah, but very, very eccentric. And Richard Lester had worked with exactly the same people.
It's it's a very telling parallel that, you know, for sound they had George and then for vision.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles loved all those records and they by complete luck, they get the guy who made them to make their records. And now also by luck, they get the same guy to make another guy who's worked with all those people to make their film. And that is Richard Lester. He really was an extraordinary person, Richard Lester.
And presumably George Martin and Richard Lester having the work with those people, they got on famously.
They did not get on at all. They really didn't like one another. I've spoken to Richard Lester. I spoke to both of them about the other, and they both snipe immediately. So it was just some kind of professional rivalry they had. But thankfully, it didn't get in the way of anything. But you'd think they would have been great pals, and they were not. No, they were not.
So this is the man himself.
So this is Richard Lester. Now, he came over from Philadelphia. He left. He went to university at 15 years old, Richard Lester, and graduated with a degree in psychology at 19, and then came over to England. He got into television in America and then came to England and went to an ITV company in 1955. And they put him in his own program called The Dick Lester Show, which was a one-off half an hour at Christmas 55. And Alan Owen was in it. You can see his name in the cast there. So they knew each other. Yep. So there's a small world here basically going on with all these people who know one another.
And we should say, just because we're in Ireland, that Dick Lester's grandfather came from County Antrim.
He did. So there's Irish influence in this film, because I think Owen had some Irish in him as well, although he was mostly Welsh. But Richard Lester did as well. And so he did the Dick Lester Show. Then he worked with Peter Sellers and Spike on a program called The Idiot Weekly, Price Tuppence. And then another one called A Show Called Fred, that is Peter Sellers you see there. And Son of Fred, that's Sellers and Spike. Basically, an early attempt to put The Goon Show, which was completely a radio creation, onto the small screen. Very difficult. Very difficult, because on radio you can play with the mind, but on television you've got to actually manifest it.
And it's very early days of ITV, and they're trying to find a winning formula. People don't know how to make television in some ways.
Yes, that's right. And there's Michael Benteen, he worked with him as well. So the same artist that George Martin is working with. So the Beatles have fallen into the company of these two people. And that is absolutely perfect for them. But there was one thing in particular about Richard Lester that they loved, and that was that he had made a thing called the Running, Jumping and Standing Still film, which was about a 10-minute short that used to show in news theatres in this country. Who remembers news theatres? You'd get them by stations, by busy railway stations.
No one remembers that.
And I think there was one hand up there. Thank you. And they would show Tom and Jerry cartoons. They would show the news, so you get Pathé Newsreel and something like that. And a little short might be Laurel and Hardy, or it might be the Running Jumping film. And the Beatles had watched this often in Liverpool. It was completely their sense of humour. Magical Mystery Tour is like the Running Jumping Standing Still film, and A Hard Day's Night is too. So we thought we'd just show you a little bit of what the Beatles loved about what Richard Lester did.
That kind of thing.
It's that kind of film. This 10, 11 minutes of that. The opening titles of that were written by or created, designed by Joe McGrath, who ended up directing Ringo in The Magic Christian and the Peter Cook and Dudley Moore TV shows that John was in. So there's just a small world, and the Beatles enter it with this film and stay very happily in that world from then on. In fact, I would argue that A Hard Day's Night is their Running, Jumping, Standing Still film. They wanted to make a film like he had made before, and here they were doing it with that same guy.
So we have this group of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, Alan Owen is hugely important in trying to get the words down on the page, because I think sometimes you think A Hard Day's Night is all improvised.
Yeah.
It is. It's so naturalistic,
natural,
and
yeah.
It's so well done.
Yeah.
But that's really not the case at all. It's fully scripted. And
it is.
Where would be the best place for Alan Owen to be if he wanted to experience the Beatles?
Well, possibly Dublin, I would think. Basically, the plan was he would spend initially 3 days with the Beatles. And they were touring the UK, and they came over to Ireland as well. And this was in November, December 63. And he spent 3 days with them, beginning in Dublin. So he flew in with them from London to Dublin and hung out with them both at the venue, the Adelphi Cinema, and also at the Gresham Hotel.
Yes, I think everyone knows the Gresham Hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I went there today, actually, just to have a look. But they're not there anymore, the Beatles.
No, they've left, have they?
They've gone. But and there is Alan Owen hanging out with the Beatles just backstage, and what he's doing is he's absorbing the way they spoke. Yeah. He's absorbing just little bits of information from them, and the relationship they have with one another, and the fact that they were a very tight bond, the four of them. But he's got that Liverpool speak, because everything is very clipped and abbreviated, yeah. And nothing, there's not a word wasted, and he wrote the script exactly like that, which is why it seems so natural to them. So he typed his script, and we're not going to show you that every page of it, but this is he actually had to sit down with a blank piece of paper in the typewriter and come up with this film.
And is this his writing, change the names?
I think that might be his names. Neil should become Nell, and Mal should become Shake. That's Neil and Mal, the two Beatles, two road managers,
yes.
who have roles in the film as Shake and Norm. But Alan Owen's film didn't have a title yet. There was talk of it being called Beatlemania, that new word that had been coined just about a month before. And the Beatles said, no way are we going to have our film called Beatlemania. Richard Lester he'd made one of those fairly risible jukebox musicals, but his had a little bit more to it called It's Trad Dad.
Yes.
And I did ask Richard Lester once, is it true that the Paul McCartney suggested that the film could be called It's Rock Cock? And he said, no. So I believe him on that one. Yeah.
Something I love about this is, you know, you read the opening scenes there.
Yeah.
And we all know the opening scene to A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
We might have a little look later on. But even though it's written that they're being chased and they're escaping down alleyways, there's still that extra frisson of what's actually happening when you make it with the Beatles.
Yeah.
That makes it very, very different.
Yeah. Of course, he couldn't have known that at the time he's putting that in the typewriter. But he had witnessed it. He was witnessing. And the thing about Hard Day's Night is one of the reasons it's so natural, not only is the script natural, but also the settings are what was actually happening in real life. So they just took truth and made fiction based on truth. But it's so close that, I mean, when they went to America in 64, they were actually filmed on a train. And that they're larking around on the train. Well, that was already scripted for A Hard Day's Night. Mm-hmm. And people who've seen the American footage say, aha, they based it on the American film, but it was already written. But that's how close fiction and non-fiction were blurring at that point.
We were talking about this just before we came on, about the things that aren't there. So you don't see any of the girls fainting.
Yes.
You don't see the real hysteria. You don't see the riot outside the Adelphi in Dublin, for example. So they're as close to reality as they can get without sort of a negative connotation to what's happening.
Yes, it's all incredibly positive. So this is all the end of 1963 now. All this is happening October, November, December. And then the Beatles go to Paris. They've got to write the songs for the film. It's already set down. There is a contract that Lennon and McCartney are going to write the soundtrack for it. So they know they've got to come up with new songs. They go to Paris in January and America in February, and they write the songs. And then they've got to come back and record them in very short time. So in just the space of a few days, 25th of February, 26th, 27th, and the 1st of March, they record not only five of the songs for the film, but also a whole bunch of other songs as well.
It is remarkable. So just to get the timeline right, if you're like, they spend a few weeks in Paris in a residency, and then they go straight to the USA where... I Want to Hold Your Hand has become the biggest selling ever single in Capitol Records history in the space of 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And they do the Ed Sullivan show appearance, and then they do the next one the following week.
Yeah.
And they couldn't be more in demand. They couldn't be more busy or big.
Mm.
And yet in those kind of 6 weeks, they are putting together these songs.
Yes. They liked hard work. I mean, there was a lot for them to do. It was just the way the business was in those days. You would do a lot of things. You would always be working in some way or another. But they were up for it. They were like 20. What was Paul McCartney was 21 at this point, and Johnny's 23, just turned 23. So they're completely up for every experience, and hard work does not faze them at all, because they've been in Hamburg working 7-8 hours a night for 3 months. So, you know, yes, okay, we'll write the songs as well. But they're not just any old songs. They're incredible songs. They're absolutely brilliant.
Something that people maybe don't really factor in is they had been a band and together for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sort of 58, 59.
Yes.
So they're arguably, they're sort of 5 or 6 years into their career at this point, albeit that only the last 20 months they've sort of been in the public eye. So as you say, they're used to that. They're a unit.
I call 58 is year one, which makes 1967, 64 year seven.
Yeah.
So they really know each other. They know what they're capable of, and nothing phases them. Mm. So they write these songs, and we've got a bit of footage from one of the recording sessions for And I Love Her that you might not have seen before.
Great stuff.
Yeah, wonderful to see that.
Yeah.
You were telling me there's actually quite a lot of this footage. This is sort of B-roll.
Yeah, United Artists had another cameraman there who was shooting without sound, although that has been synced to a degree. But a lot of this, about an hour and a half of footage of them shooting A Hard Day's Night, and most of it's unseen.
So we're looking at Peter Jackson's 2028.
That would be nice.
Or
I'll happily give the film to him if he needs it.
Yeah, take my money now. Mm. If anyone would like to know more about A Hard Day's Night, the album, there's 2 Nothing Is Real episodes.
What Apparently so.
Yeah, so you can take those out. Let's get into the movie itself. The movie is somewhat filmed in not total chronological order, but vague chronological order, which is
Richard Lester has said since that he was aware that since they had never made a film before, it might confuse them if they suddenly shoot in one of the end scenes first. So he basically shot the beginning of the film first so that they got into their stride with it. And that meant riding on a train. And why was it a train? Because the Beatles had told Alan Owen a story of a true incident that had happened to them when they were coming down from Liverpool once on the train, where they met this upper-crust guy in the first-class carriage who was, you know, very much against them because they were young and everything like that. And they had the same kind of riff with him in the carriage that we're going to see. Alan Owen basically wrote that as a scene, but it was based on the truth. So that meant they were going to be starting on a film.
And when they
on a train.
And when they woke up this morning, they weren't in Equity.
No, they had to join the Actors Union Equity, so they were proposed and seconded there on the platform at Paddington Station in London by 2 of the actors in the film. And so this is one of the pictures. They arrive at Paddington to go off shooting, and Richard Lester leaning out of the window. He obviously realises he's going to have some very trying circumstances making this film, because he's going to have to contend with the fact that every time the Beatles are outside anywhere, the public are near them. And the public were really crazy for the Beatles at this point. So he's got the scripted mania, and he's got the unscripted mania as well.
Yeah. Let's talk through here. Here's Paul looking at his script.
Yeah, they hadn't had much time to familiarise themselves with the script, but it was okay, because Alan Owen had written very short lines for them, and they really only had to learn a line or two at a time. George reading his script. George being fitted with a microphone so that they could actually get some sound while they were working on the train, although I think ultimately they revoiced it.
This is us backstage about half an hour ago. This is what was happening.
Yeah.
Getting our microphones put on, strapped to our legs.
John shaving with his microphone. That's Alan Owen behind him, and Norman Rossington, who will come back to, one of the actors in the film.
Shall we play the clip?
Play the clip from the train scene.
From the train.
Yes, let's do that.
Should we just mention Richard Vernon is what age, Stephen?
39.
Richard Vernon, the man with the moustache, is 39. Keep that in mind.
Will
Very clever of Richard Lester.
It's very Goonish.
To introduce the surrealism of that, the train hasn't stopped, but suddenly they're outside running alongside it. I mean, it's not explained, it doesn't need to be explained. No. But he's playing with it straight away.
And it works. It just
works
completely.
Yeah, it works perfectly.
Richard Vernon, 39, and had served in the Navy?
He had served, in the Navy in the Second World War, maybe at the very end of it.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. So because they're filming on a train, where did the train go? We used to travel every day for 6 days from Paddington down to the West Country, where they would stop and have lunch somewhere, and the train would turn around or whatever, and then they would film going back to London as well. And so this is real-life Beatlemania here. This is Minehead in Somerset. And the headmistress very kindly let the children out of school that lunchtime because she knew they were all going to go anyway. That little ditch there was named in the local newspaper as Beeching's Brook. Because this was the era of Lord Beeching, of course, and the cuts to the railway.
And they're just trying to have a normal lunch with a giant bottle of champagne.
This is the Dublin Belfast Enterprise lunch.
Yeah.
This is their life. They're just... The film shows them how they're kind of captured, and here they are captured.
It's literally they're in a cage and people are coming to watch them. Yeah. It's like being in a zoo.
Yeah, Richard Lester and Walter Shenson there. Yeah. So that was in Minehead, and during another day of that week, they stopped in Taunton to change trains, or the engine was changed or something like that. So this is Taunton Station. This is being filmed from inside the Beatles railway carriage.
Here's the star of the show.
And this is an indication of how everybody had Beatlemania. It wasn't just for teenagers or young children. Her name is Mrs. Drain. Mrs. Violet Drain.
Very Monty Python name.
Yeah. And so she has a camera there. And that's a guy from the local newspaper, and she's evidently taken a picture of the Beatles, and he's writing it down for his piece. And he must have taken the film away and had it developed. Because in the Bristol Evening Post, it was not only were the Beatles the entire front page, except for the Dave Clark 5 at the bottom there, but also there is a piece about Mrs. Drain and her photograph. So that is the photograph that she's taken with that camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, railwayman's wife, Mrs. Drain.
And it's got her address there, 24 Cyril Street, if you want to. Have you been there?
I haven't been there, okay. I'm assuming nature will have taken its course by now. Yeah.
I love that picture. You can see the reflection of the people looking in.
Yeah.
Can you see the person on the right?
It's Donovan.
He gets everywhere.
He doesn't like to talk about it.
So, on the train, everyone wants to have their picture taken with the Beatles. This is the crew of the train. And Wilfred Bramble, we'll come back to him in just a moment, but he's in the picture too. But moving on, this is the man responsible for the great photography in A Hard Day's Night, Gilbert Taylor. He was the cameraman, and Hard Day's Night is beautifully shot.
Well, he had just come off, I think, Dr. Strangelove.
Ah, yeah, well, that would make sense.
And, so he then goes on to work with Roman Polanski in Repulsion. But they had top-notch people. I mean, Lester is surrounded by people who are...
Yeah, he knows who to bring in. Yeah, and the next woman is Rita Davison, continuity, using the 1964 version of a laptop.
Like, she did a great job because, you know, once again, we think it's a real documentary piece. It's obviously like a movie shot over a number of weeks.
Yes.
And for the most part, it flows.
Yeah, in trying circumstances. I mean, to the point where she's actually got to type her notes on a moving train. But she did a good job. Everybody did a very good job. We're going to show you another clip now of a woman, two schoolgirls, meant to be, one of whom would have a very, very long life in this business.
Hey, look at the talent. Let's give him a ball.
Should I?
All right, but don't rush. None of your five-bar gate jumps and over sorts of stuff.
What's that supposed to mean?
I don't know. I thought it just sounded distinguished, like...
George Harrison's car.
I'm sorry, miss. You mustn't fraternise with me prisoners.
Prisoners?
Convict in transit. Tipping low legs them off them.
You are?
You are.
Get out, ladies. Get out while you can.
So, Wilfred Bramble, yes. He was in the film as the King Mixer, if you like. That was his role, wasn't it? He was Paul's Irish grandfather, the King Mixer. And, of course, he was Irish.
Yeah, from Dublin, born in 1912 in Dublin. We have some pictures of him in the second half as well.
Yeah.
But he worked in the Abbey and the Gate theatres.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that he's very clean is the running gag.
He's very clean because this point, yeah.
Dirty old man from Steptoe.
Yeah. You dirty old man. Yeah. So the constant references to him being clean in A Hard Day's Night, just as an in-joke.
That must have gone completely over the heads of everyone else in the world.
Yeah, anyone who hadn't seen Steptoe and something, basically. Yeah, yeah. So Patty and George makes a beeline for Patty, if not on day one, then certainly on day two. As we see from Patty's own diary here, George Harrison asked me out and wrote his name a couple of times in her diaries, which she obviously was carrying with her. And she was part of another small part in the film later on, but basically she was often on the set after this. And a few days later, when Ringo shot a scene on his own, she was actually there in the Turk's Head
pub. Amazing picture.
I think this is a wonderful picture. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
She could have had Ringo.
I know. Look at what you could have won.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to actually show you a little bit. I think there's a picture here of the scene, because Ringo, the second half of the film is basically set around Ringo running away, which we'll come back to. But there's a little bit of footage of them actually shooting that scene there. So this is a real pub. This is not a set. This is a pub in Twickenham, in Middlesex. They shot at Twickenham Film Studios, so a lot of the locations are very close to the studio.
This person here is Bob Godfrey. If you know who Bob Godfrey is.
The man with the beard. Bob Godfrey, yeah.
Creator of Henry's Cat and Rhubarb and Custard and other cartoons.
Yeah. Hmm. Shall we do the theme music?
Yes, you start.
He turns up in Help as a thug.
Does he?
Yeah, Bob Godfrey. He's an extra in Help as well.
In that running, jumping, standing still film, the guy who runs around the record, what's his name, from the Alberts.
Bruce Lacy.
He's in Help as the guy
who cuts
the grass with the chopping teeth.
I mean, they once they get people, once you're in that circle.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So the film has tremendous energy. There are so many scenes in which there's a lot of activity going on. It's a film where they're hemmed in and then suddenly they burst out. Yeah. And we're going to see that in a minute as the end of the first half. But I just wanted to show you this picture because they had this incredible scene where they were running around a field as it turned out, Gatwick Airport. And they were filmed from a helicopter just above them.
Look at the
health and safety.
Jeopardy in that picture. I mean, had that helicopter fallen out of the sky, that would have been the end of the Beatles. But in those days, you just got on with it, right? Yeah. I mean, there was an insurance policy on them, but apart from that, you just got on with it. And there's an aeroplane coming into land at Gatwick, which is only about half a mile away as well. So this is another lovely location. Richard Lester found some really good spots for them to film.
The thing that's always important to remember, I think, whether it's reading your books or whatever, is that when these things are happening, the future is unwritten.
Yeah.
That the Beatles don't know that in less than 5 years they'll be looking at each other filming Let It Be.
Yeah.
That they are just living their lives day to day. Often when we're looking back, we just think of the whole story. But on the day they're doing that, they don't know what the day's ahead.
And they're just trusting that Lester knows what he's doing. If you want us to run around in this field, we'll run around. You know, if you want to put a helicopter 20 feet above us, then put it there. You know, and we'll do it. Yeah, well, they were up for it, yeah. So they were going to shoot this scene. This is one of the breakout scenes in A Hard Day's Night. It's going to represent also the end of this first half. So we're going to have a short interval after this, and then we'll be back for part two.
Yes, we'll kick it off, and then we'll just run away and escape, just like the Beatles do. We hope you enjoy your drink.
Stand by me, love.
Going to run away.
See you later.
I'll get you.